Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Marie Claire and the Thinker Girls present.
We need to talk about.
We need to talk about.
We need to talk about.
No, seriously, we actually do. Today's topic,
anxiety.
A foreword from the editor of Marie Claire, Nikki Brigger.
Hi, I'm Nikki Brigger. I'm the editor of Marie Claire. When we found out that anxiety is the leading cause of ill health in girls and women in Australia, we were staggered. A shocking 1 in 3 women and 1 in 5 men will experience this debilitating condition at some stage in their life. And it starts when girls are really young as 5. Unfortunately, many people let the symptoms snowball just because they fear discrimination, which is why we were so keen to bring this condition to light. Enjoy our first podcast series. Over to the Thinker Girls.
Juanita Phillips is an Australian journalist and news presenter. She's the weeknight presenter of ABC News in Sydney, and she recently opened up about her journey with anxiety to Marie Claire magazine for their anxiety edition.
Juanita, thank you for your time today.
Oh, you're welcome.
We both read the Marie Claire feature on you, and we were so excited to chat to you about this because what came across was just this real clarity and this real, lovely but very clear way of expressing something that obviously can be very internal issue for you. Could you talk to us about how you feel about sharing? Because we just off the mic spoke about how not everybody is always comfortable about that. But from what we can already see, have you ever had a problem with sharing about your anxiety?
Not once I got to understand it. I think when I was younger, I was very reticent to talk about it because I thought that maybe I was the only one who was feeling that way. But then when I was in my 30s, I had a bit of counseling and I learnt that I had anxiety, and I also learnt, where it came from, and I got to understand it a bit. And so over the years, I've got to really know it. It's almost, I wouldn't call it an old friend, but, I've got to know my anxiety really well and understand it, where it comes from, what it's triggered by, how to deal with it. And I've even learned to kind of appreciate it in a way because it pops up and tells me that, my life's out of balance. Mm. So no, I've never really had an issue since then talking about it because I think it's just so common.
Mm. Where or how was the first way your anxiety started to flare up? Even if now in hindsight that it was anxiety, but maybe at the time you weren't aware that it was anxiety. What was that first kind of experience where you went, what is this? And something's not quite right.
Well, I can sort of look back and say that probably it started when I was about 10, I'd say, because I remember my mum taking me around to a number of doctors because I had really bad stomach pains and I couldn't sleep at night. I remember I used to lie awake at night worrying about things, worrying about school or worrying about family stuff. And so we went around to various doctors and they said, oh, there's nothing wrong with her. And I don't even know if they said, oh, maybe it's nerves. I mean, in the old days, they used to call it nerves.
Yeah, my mum speaks about that. Her dad being sent, and this was such an off-the-cuff comment that she said, my dad would be sent off for weeks at a time for his nerves.
Yes.
And it's not a term that I had heard before or knew had existed within my family.
Yeah, like that was in the 70s. So it was like, oh, yeah, people suffer from nerves. Mm-hmm. And that's, I guess that was their word for anxiety. And then so over the years, kind of at various sort of stressful points in my life, it would flare up again. And then I got to a point in my 30s where I thought, oh, this is just debilitating, it's just robbing me of enjoyment of life. And that's when I got some counselling and learnt to understand it. Mm. Didn't mean that it went away, but just meant that I knew what it was and how to deal with it. With anxiety, it just sort of snowballs and you've got to find sort of a way to short circuit it. Otherwise, it just it just carries you along with it and gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
It feels so real too.
Mm.
It started off from, I don't know if I should have given that pass back, to all of a sudden, I don't know, it can be anything. And then the extension of where it kind of went from, I don't know if this is your experience, but feels so real, even though it really wouldn't have been a thought if you didn't think about the past in the first place.
Yeah.
It's a long-winded way of saying it, but it's just to paint a clear picture of how really full on it can go.
Yeah, catastrophizing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you really don't want to be there at the other end of the catastrophizing, so you need to be able to kind of recognize it in the beginning and go, oh, no, hang on, that's not really rational.
And that's a term I think for myself have only really understood this year, because I think as women, we often are put as overthinkers, as a part of your personality. As women, I think we overcarers or worry too much, or there's this real maternal thing that is really heavily linked with being anxious. And often those things can then slip through the cracks because it is really normalized in some way. And I have always been classified as an overthinker. The thinker girls is essentially named because of my thinking capacity. And at times it's 100% to my detriment. Was catastrophizing something that fell within your symptoms or things that you experienced?
Yeah, definitely. And I think one of the worst periods, one when my kids were really little, and this is when it sort of manifested at work. But yeah, I remember being on the sofa and just something would go wrong with my health. Nothing major, you know, there'd be some little niggle. And before I knew it, I'd be Googling my symptoms and going, oh my God, I'm terminal,
yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
and just,
that's very common, isn't it? Now that we're here. Yeah.
But especially once you had kids,
yeah.
Because it's like, I'm not going to be here for them. Was that almost like a trigger or an added element?
And I think it was just doing too much. Like, I think in a really anxiety, a lot of anxiety has a really simple, you know, root, and that is simply that we do too much and we just load too much onto ourselves. And I think that's why women tend to suffer from it more because, you know, these days we're expected to have a career and as well as look after the house, raise children, and just having children in itself is like a massive kind of, you know, thing you've got to get your head around. So I think that's one of those key periods. And that's why I guess women get postnatal depression and they, you know, their anxiety flares up because you're dealing with this whole new set of circumstances. Plus you're meant to just capably carry on, you know, doing everything that you normally do.
My anxiety probably began in one big event when I was 28 years old and I had twins who were extremely premature, born at 29 weeks. And all of a sudden, you know, sitting next to me were, you know, two kilo babies that I all of a sudden had to handle. It was just like an extreme moment where all of a sudden the expectation on me to be a mum was just sort of like handed to me so quickly.
I had just moved school, so I came from a small country town. Well, not really a small country town, it was Barrel. And then I moved to Pymble Ladies College, and that's like a 3,000 girls school. It's huge, and there was 300 girls in my year. And the girls, they were lovely, but it's very cliquey. And I think I was so used to that small 17 people in a class, there was no drama, two cliques, girls being quite mean. And I think I got socially anxious. I was worried about people liking me. I was worried about making friends. I was worried about being cool. And I would just have panic attacks.
My earliest memory of experience anxiety was probably in my 20s when I had a bad breakup with a boyfriend, as we all do. For me, it felt a little bit unsure of the world. And it was probably the first time that things, I'm always been a person that, you know, if you A plus B plus C will equal, you know, and I just, for the first time, it was like, well, I did all of that and it didn't work out. So for me, it's sort of presented in, I guess, going back into myself a bit more, questioning things a little bit more and feeling a little bit more hesitant.
Here's Jill Stark, author of Happily Never After.
There's challenges in the modern age that we didn't have in previous generations. I do think that we live in a pretty frantic on a crazy busy world where it's really hard to switch off. And I think that that has created a few challenges, but it's not the only issue, I think. Yeah, we do live at a time that is, we're very on edge, I think, in a way that we perhaps weren't in calmer days when we weren't constantly plugged into a bunch of devices.
A bit of the book that I've, from my understanding that I've read, was that a lot of the discovery around what makes a person who they are and how their fight or flight is created is around that first 3-year mark when you're born. And I found this really fascinating. Could you share with our listeners a little bit about the discovery you had from what life was like in your early years and what impact you think that could play on someone's anxiety later in life?
So, you know, 90% of the brain's development happens before the age of 5. So the way that we interact with the world in those early years is really critical in how we adapt or don't adapt, as the case may be, in terms of our attachment style and how secure we end up becoming. So for me, I grew up in what was a very loving and sort of middle class, you know, quite comfortable family in Scotland. And compared to some of my friends who had fractured families and a lot of difficulties, I felt like that I couldn't possibly feel, I felt guilty for having these mental health issues because, you know, to the outside world, I had this perfect family. And when I look back at it, it's not to say that my parents didn't love me, but there was a lot of drama happening in my household as a young girl. This is what I unpacked in therapy, that when I was born, before I was born, my father suffered a quite serious nervous breakdown while mum was pregnant with me. And he was really, really unwell, like to the point of being almost catatonic for a long time. And by the time I was born, he was recovering, but he was still not in a great place. And at the same time, my brother, who's 3 years older than me, was very ill pretty much for the first 6 years of his life. He had meningitis. He had a kidney problem. He had issues that put him in and out of hospital. And so for me, as a baby, my parents were really distracted. And that's not to say they didn't love me and that they didn't do the best they could. Every parent, you know, would hope that they would. But for me, as a child trying to attach to the caregivers around me, I didn't understand that their distraction was not caused by a lack of love, but because they had a sick child and my dad was still recovering from his own issues. So my little brain that was developing and wasn't able, as at that point we're precognitive, we don't understand, we don't have the brain function to rationally look at what's going on around us and go, oh, okay, mum's not giving me attention because she's looking after my brother. We start to internalize that and start to blame ourselves. So I think what's interesting is that for me, looking back, I was like, well, I didn't have any what I would describe as genuine trauma, you know, that I wasn't abused or I didn't go through a car accident or experience the death of a parent, all of these things that a lot of people go through who end up with mental health issues, that I thought that I had to have experienced something really dramatic for these to explain these mental health issues. And as it turns out, you know, it doesn't have to be something, this deep, dark secret to explain why we behave the way we do. And so that in a way has been really liberating to realize that there's nothing sinister really underneath it all, but there is a reason.
A few times on our podcast channel, I will often make comment about blokes being boy men, and it seems to play out so much more obvious, or even it's just a bit more transparent with men. Whereas I think with women, we're very much tied within this old storyline of being intense or doing our heads in or being high maintenance or being hysterical. And I think anxiety has somewhere gotten intertwined into that, where a lot of girls or women are feeling like that's just a part of being who you are. I'm an overthinker. I do my head in. I mean, speaking to that, Do you think that there are a lot of people that suffer from anxiety that are undiagnosed or aren't getting treated because of that issue, that potentially it's just like a suck it up, this is the way your brain works, you need to move on with it and work with it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of women, I think both men and women struggle with this for different reasons. I think with women, a lot of the time, as you say, it's that whole kind of patriarchal view of women as being hysterical and, you know, having your period and being hormonal and being led by your emotions rather than your brain. And I think that in a way there's almost a sense of shame about that. On the flip side, men are very much this suck it up and get on with it kind of thing. And I think that is damaging for men to the point of being deadly. And we see that in the suicide rates in young men, that this notion of not being able to show emotion, to be able to cry, that masculinity is somehow equated with toughness and toughness equals not showing any emotional vulnerability. That's really damaging.
I didn't initially tell anyone. I kind of played it off as it was an asthma attack. I didn't want to know that I had anxiety because I think when you're 14, it's almost like a show of, I thought it was a weakness initially, and I didn't want it to give air to this, that I'm nervous around people. And it wasn't until it got really out of hand when I was in high school, like the year 9, that I was having panic attacks all the time, like once a week after school. And I'd feel sick going to class and, you know, crying just all the time, that I finally kind of told my mum. I was like, I don't know if I'm feeling depressed or what's happening. I couldn't get out of bed. And I went to a psychologist. And that's when I started to kind of get help and be more open about what it actually was, what was going on, because I didn't even really know what I was experiencing. I didn't know the ins and outs of anxiety. The psychologist said, you need to learn how to breathe. So whenever you kind of feel a panic attack coming on, you just take deep breaths and you sit down and you count your breaths and you count in for 5 seconds and out for 5 seconds, and you just slow everything down. And you do this whenever you're feeling, you know, like short of breath and then a panic attack's about to come on.
I wondered if you could speak to a little bit, I know within the Marie Claire issue where it was such a stunning photo of you, by the way, the water with your yoga mat. I wanted to know, you spoke quite briefly in that about a few years ago that you did have an anxiety attack or a panic attack while you were on air.
Yes.
How? Were there other people? Was it an internal thing? Did other people realize that was going on with you?
It was just the weirdest thing. I didn't actually feel that stressed or anxious. A lot of my anxiety doesn't manifest as me thinking, you know, consciously, oh, I'm anxious. I felt fine and I just went to air and started reading the bulletin, and then I just lost my voice. And basically what happened afterwards, and I tried to struggle on, but I literally, there was no sound coming out of my voice box.
Wow.
It went. And the larynx just closed up. And when I went and got it checked out afterwards, and apparently when the body is under extreme stress, for example, when you're drowning, your larynx closes as a mechanism to try for you to survive. And I had what they call a laryngeal spasm, where the larynx just goes like that, just went,
your body's like, nope,
I'm not talking anymore. Sorry. Thanks very much.
So what happened from that point?
They had to, I literally couldn't speak. So they took the Melbourne bulletin instead. And then I just went out to the newsroom and just took a few minutes, and I wasn't sure what had happened either. But anyway, I ended up going back on air and finishing the bulletin.
Yeah.
And I was able to do that. And it was only later that I realised, oh, okay, that must have been like a panic attack.
Mm. So when you got it checked out, was it something that you've been fearful of happening again, or, you know, there are particular, you know, techniques if it were to kind of flare up or present in that way that you'd know kind of how to approach it?
Yeah, I think it was just a one-off because it was a super stressful time of my life, and that's what made me kind of step back and think, okay, this is crazy. I really just looked at my life and thought, ridiculous.
It's your job to speak.
So how do I kind of wind things back? And so I just entered a different phase of my life where I just decided to say no to a lot of things, have a pretty quiet life actually, and just I just learned to be very mindful of not taking on more than I can handle. And
protecting yourself.
That's it.
It is a real issue that we've got, because as much as we have this essentially this public campaign of speaking up and being there for each other, there is still this underlying cultural stigma behind people speaking up. How did the workplace respond to your experience, and have you had experience in either witnessing other people feeling uneasy about it, or yourself in other workplaces perhaps?
Not really. I'm really lucky working at the ABC, which is a very supportive workplace. So I never noticed any sort of negative responses to me. And I've had quite a few colleagues that I know have gone through their own mental health experiences, whether it's depression or anxiety, and they've been really well supported. Hasn't been sort of, you know, publicised or spoken about very much, but you just quietly learn that, you know, various of your colleagues have at a certain period of time needed some support or some time off for those kind of issues. So again, I've never luckily had that experience of being in a workplace where it's, you know, a stigma.
It's incredible.
What other techniques have you used to be able to kind of, I'm assuming with the yoga mat in the pic, that wasn't just a random kind of, hey, I'm just on the way to the studio.
You never know, these stylists really like to up things.
Yeah, we thought we'd do the yoga story, right? You know, could you do the downward dog?
You're like, no stress. Yeah, chuck me one.
I'm more of a jogger, lady.
I'm definitely not a jogger. No, actually the yoga thing, I really feel like that kind of saved my life during another stressful time. That was when I was going through a divorce and becoming a single mum. So again, my stress levels were pretty high, and I was feeling I wasn't sleeping at night. And I just thought, I have to do something, or I'm going to start drinking an awful lot of red wine. And then a friend introduced me to Bikram yoga, and I just got into that, you know, in a huge way, like practicing 5 or 6 times a week.
Yeah, wow.
Which is totally over the top, and I would never actually recommend it. It was good for just totally getting rid of. Actually just getting away from the thoughts in my head. That was really what I was looking for, I think. So that helped me over a sort of a 2 to 3 year period. And then since then I've just gradually sort of wound back on it, and I do a different type of yoga, and it's much more relaxed. And
it's funny, I've had this the same conversation with 2 or 3 people, I reckon, over the last few months that have said, oh, you know, I'm an overthinker, I can't sleep at night. And I'm like, you should try to do yoga. And they're like, no way, that's the worst thing I could do. I don't want to be alone with my thoughts. So it's funny how it's like, and I'm like, you're the exact type of person that needs to do it.
Yeah.
To get more of a familiarity around being in your head. At first, was that challenging for you?
Not really. I think I was so desperate for it. And because Bikram, that style of yoga, is really hard, so all you can think about is the pain.
I was just concentrating on not fainting.
Or you're feeling so hot. You just think, oh, God, it's so unpleasant. Oh, these people smell. Oh, look at all that sweat dripping. You are distracted. And I think with anxiety or depression or anything like that, that's why exercise is so good, especially if you're doing something that is particularly challenging. So you don't have space in your head to be, you know, churning over the same old stuff.
And so just if anyone is listening, and we are, you know, there's plenty of people that I think are hearing about anxiety, hearing about mental illness, but are still sitting there wondering, is mine that severe? What was the first step you took when you had to find a therapist, or you took a first step to really navigate and explore in your internal, like you started to explore within?
I think, yeah, so that would have been in my early 30s, I think. And I'm not sure how I tracked down a therapist, but obviously just asked around, and I didn't really know why. I just thought something's wrong here and I'd like to kind of figure out what's going on. And that was a really valuable first step. And since then I've gone back a couple of times to various counsellors just to talk over things that have been going on in my life. And that again just reminds me that You know, that there are certain triggers in life and there are certain stressful situations. So if you're feeling anxiety, it's probably just a completely normal reaction to, you know, an extreme situation. And understanding that is really helpful.
And if there is any other advice for anybody thinking about approaching this or something that I suppose you would have told yourself, what would that be?
What would it be? I think really in terms of young women in particular, I'd say, and I know it might fall on deaf ears, just try not to take on too much and try not to have such high expectations of yourself. You know, I see so many young women and they're incredible powerhouses and they're out there, they're studying, they're working, they've got a relationship or they're looking for one, they're thinking about having a family. And I'd just say, you know, take it really easy, be easy on yourself because you can sort of handle it in your 20s, I reckon, but you just get to a point where it overwhelms you and then you collapse in a heap. So
it's pretty celebrated though, that can do it all, you're killing it kind of vibe, especially for women these days.
Until you can't.
I think it's hard
because I think age and all that, you get to a point where something does jam you back, and it is interesting that it either takes that point or some form of slowdown before then. But I think we still are at a point where it's taking that real health issue to come on before anyone's really learning the lesson.
Yeah, because you don't want to get to that point because it you risk sort of losing all of the stuff that you've worked really hard for. You know, your career and your friends and your social life and all this great stuff going on. If you get to the point of being really unwell, then you risk losing that.
Yeah, it's true. Juanita Phillips, it has been a pleasure to talk. Thanks for you're in between bulletins and doing bits and pieces and you're going on holiday tomorrow. So we really appreciate your time. If you do want to follow Juanita, you can find her on Twitter at Juanita_.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Well, Philip, thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure, girls. Thank you very much for having me.
I have a perfectionistic personality, so I tend to really accentuate that perfectionistic side of myself. So now when I have anxiety, I tend to try and, by feeling out of control, I try to really regain control. So what I find I do is anything from at home, everything in the house having to be perfect to the point where my husband will know if my anxiety's up, because a couple of weeks ago he found me repainting a skirting board that had 3 scuff marks on it. I've learnt that sometimes you've got to just take your hands off the wheel, and that's been a big learning for me. So I saw somebody about it and they spoke to me about, well, what would happen if you took your hands off the wheel? Do you really think it would all crash? Have you ever tried it, or is it sort of what's the idea of what's the worst thing that can happen in this situation if you were to take your hands off the wheel?
It's funny because for a really long time when I would have blow-ups with partners or different people, I thought I was an angry person. But yet my personality really didn't match with that. I'm quite kind and quite calm and incredibly spiritual and can be very, very introverted at times. And once I figured out that my panic plays out through anger at times, it really opened up my mind to the possibilities that anxiety can play up and show you. And your book really spoke to me in that it opened up that potentially there is always going to be trauma from really big events and really awful experiences like being raped or being attacked. But there are also ways that you are able to feel unsafe and really, I guess, uneasy as a kid that can essentially lead you to feel some really insane anxiety.
I've written the book that I wanted to read when I was in a really tough place because all I could see on the shelves were these very simplistic kind of didactic kind of, you buy this book and here's 5 steps to happiness. And that's just not realistic and it's not helpful. And I think I got into a lot of trouble, and I think our culture gets into a lot of trouble in believing there's a quick fix, whether it's a pill or, as you say, a binging on Netflix or buying stuff we don't need or, you know, and all of these things I still do. But I don't expect that to cure me, you know, and I don't expect it to. It's a lot of the time these quick fixes are a numbing agent. They're not the answer. And, you know, the answer is, there is no answer, there is no easy answer, and it is a lifelong journey. And accepting that and realizing that, as you say, it's almost sometimes an hour by hour, for me, sometimes minute by minute, depending on how tough the day is. And I think a lot of the time, particularly for women as well, we'll find ourselves going, oh, I'm having the same emotional issue again. What is wrong with me? Why is this happening to me again? I thought I'd got past this. It's like, give yourself a break. When you think about it, the way that these habits are formed, you know, it's taken years, decades to form these habits. You're not going to just change that overnight. And also, my psychologist always says to me, don't compare yourself to where you were, 6 days ago or 6 months ago. Like, compare yourself to 6 years ago and like, look at it as a long-term kind of progress, like that it is gradual, but that's how change happens. It doesn't happen in like a puff of smoke overnight.
No. And, you know, it is cliche. There's so many things that you throw out of all the good things that you get come from work, you know, like it's, and this isn't any different. You work hard for your jobs or you work hard for your, you know, a lot of the time to have a baby or you work hard for that house that you save for. Yet when it comes to ourselves, we have this expectation that everything's just supposed to kind of work out. And if not, it's.
But even then, I mean, like we often plan for the wedding, not the marriage, the birth, not the baby, you know, buying the house, not servicing the mortgage. Like, so there's still that sort of end point. If we'll buy it, we'll get this and everything will be perfect. And I think like there's so much a tendency, and this is something that I still work on, is when something goes wrong to say, oh, I'm a failure or I can't believe this happened. And you just ignore all the progress that you've made. You ignore all the great things that you have done and you focus on that one small misstep or the one step backwards. Like that's why I keep a gratitude journal every night, because otherwise if I looked at my other journal, which is just me outpouring everything, which is helpful, like just getting everything out of my head, if I was to read that back, it would look like my life is one big long purgatory of abject misery, and it's not. So the gratitude journal allows me to record my small wins and go, oh yeah, that's right. No, I did this and I did that, and like not just focus on what hasn't gone right. And we do that so often that we look at this small step backwards is evidence of my complete failure as a human. You know, it's so toxic to us. We've just got to try so hard to treat yourself the way you would a friend. Like, you wouldn't say to a friend who's had, you know, too many drinks on a night out, like, oh, God, Jim, you're such a loser. Why did you do that? Like, you said you weren't going to do that again. You did. Like, you would treat them with compassion and support and be gentle.
And kind of, yeah, and zoom out a little. It's a hard thing to do, but if you can stick it on as many post-it notes and put it around your house, it helps.
At the time, I don't think I really did manage it very well. I mean, I had my husband and my mum-in-laws, which helped. But I think as I got better at managing it was because I started to, like, set myself these little goals along the way. So in the morning, it was about getting up and getting dressed and actually getting out for a walk. That was my first thing. And the walking was amazing. So even if it was half an hour, but the getting up process, it gets you into a bit of a routine for yourself. You know, you get up, you have a shower, you get yourself dressed, and then you say, I'm going to walk half an hour to the shops and back, get myself a coffee. Like, that changes your whole day compared to sitting in your pajamas, trapped in a house with two babies, not knowing what the hell you're doing. I think that was the biggest step forward in terms of managing it.
I really drew on supportive friends. I went and also saw someone professionally, and I did some counseling treatments. They put me on a really mild antidepressant, which I don't know if I necessarily needed, but I wonder if psychologically for me at the time that was good. And then just started really trying to exercise, focus, be positive.
After having two kids, I feel like I know my body quite well. And so what I do is I take myself off into the bedroom or the bathroom, and I do some deep breathing, and I have to try and recognize that the nausea isn't actually my body being sick. It's my mind. So I have to try and convince myself that I'm not going to throw up. I'm totally fine. It's not an illness. I'm just feeling anxious.
Wow, I have learnt a lot from that episode.
Yeah, learnt a lot, but also did you feel triggered by that at all? Like, listening back or doing some of the bits and pieces that we did for that episode, was like, talking about anxiety, is that a trigger for anxiety?
100%. I mentioned to Jill after we recorded her part of that podcast that it was really triggering her book, and so I've had to read it in sections. I think it is exhausting when there are people that are able to describe really core feelings that you have as an anxious person, that you feel at the time you're the only person in the world that could possibly be feeling this. So when you hear someone saying that, not only is it hard to hear because it was obviously a challenging part of your day or your life, but then also it's so internal that you feel almost exposed, or there's something that it touches in you from somewhere else because you think that no one's ever going
to
get it.
Well, that's why I wanted to ask you, because I figured that may be your answer, just sitting across from you doing some of the chats that we have for this particular episode. And I think it's really important to point out that listening to this, if you suffer from anxiety or feelings of anxiety, that it's not going to feel that nice to start work on it. You know, like, you don't get to the other side, and, you know, even Stace, someone that speaks about this on the reg, you don't find it easy. So I just wanted to make that really kind of known, that if you're feeling a bit flat or poor after this, that's also completely normal, because it's going to be hard to start working on it, right?
That's right. Lifeline is the number 13 11 14 as a beginning point. They can give you some other contacts if you are looking to expand your mental health plan, to look into ways that you might be able to tackle some of your issues. And there's also a suicide callback service on 1300 659 467 if you are feeling quite triggered or not yourself today.
This has been a co-production between the Thinker Girls and Marie Claire.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.